From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When she set out to write a biography of the Islamic prophet Muhammad, the journalist Leslie Hazelton knew plenty had already been written. But much of it was clouded, she says, by piety and bigotry. Hazelton wanted to write about Muhammad not as a symbol, not even as a subject, but as a man. She says she wanted the vibrancy and vitality of a real life lived. The story she tells is of a neglected orphan, an outsider, who becomes the ultimate insider, the leader of his people and the founder of a great faith. A man concerned with social justice, who railed against corruption and greed, and who was deeply concerned with the idea of unity. Today in the program, Leslie Hazelton will join us to talk about this man she found. Her book is called The First Muslim, after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the journalist Leslie Hazelton is joining us to talk about her book, The First Muslim. It's a biography of the Islamic prophet Muhammad. Hazelton has talked about how, with all that's been written about Muhammad, there wasn't much that gave him a sense of being a real human being. That was the person she was interested in. She didn't want to write about a symbol. She wasn't interested in the version of the man distorted by piety or by bigotry. She was interested in the real man. And her book is the story of a neglected orphan who rises to be one of the most influential figures of all time. We'll talk about his life today and about his radical ideas that would challenge the establishment of the time and change the world forever. Leslie Hazelton is a journalist who reported from Jerusalem for more than 12 years. Her work has appeared in Time magazine, The New York Times, and Harper's, among other publications. Among her other books is After the Prophet, which tells the story of the Shia-Sunni split in Islam. And she's joining us today from NPR member station KUOW in Seattle, Washington. Leslie Hazelton, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Doug.
Well, let's start with, I mentioned there in the introduction, your, I guess it could be described as frustration about what you were seeing about Muhammad, and that is that it wasn't a fully fleshed out human being. That was what you were interested in. When did you first become interested in wanting to tell this story in the first place?
Yeah, frustration is a good word for it. What happened was that I read several biographies of Muhammad as background research for the previous book on the Shia-Sunni split, mm-hmm. which happened within 50 years of his death. And it struck me then that though I seemed to know a lot about him, I still had really no sense of who he really was, of the man himself. It's as though he was sort of weighed down by the sheer volume of words that had been written about him, weighed down partly by piety, partly by judgmentalism, partly by a certain timidity in the way people wrote about him. What happened was that the moment I finished After the Prophet, it just became clear that I had to write about the man himself. Mm.
You know, there are two parts that I wanted to ask you about just initially before we jump in. Mm. And that is your perspective. One, you come at this as an agnostic Jew. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in the way, because the way you, and we'll get into this as we go, but the way you talk about Muhammad and his experience on Mount Hira mm-hmm. as being utterly real. I think that's interesting language from an agnostic, and I think your perspective is interesting. I wanted to talk about, say something about that if you would first, your perspective as an agnostic coming mm-hmm. to this subject.
Well, this is exactly my point, that when, you know, is that when we see him as a man, when we go back to the earliest Islamic biographies and go through them and begin to get a sense of who he really was, then he comes alive.
Yeah.
As an agnostic, not an atheist, an agnostic.
Yeah.
An agnostic, I think, acknowledges what is unknowable. So, for instance, you had this, imagine, if you will, this agnostic Jew, myself, puzzling for months on end at the pivotal mystical moment of Islam, which was what happened on Mount Hira, this mountain just outside Mecca, one night in the month of Ramadan in the year 610, when he had the first revelation of the Quran. And asking this question, haunted by it in a way, in the full knowledge that there is no knowing. There was nobody else there except Muhammad
yeah.
and if you are a believer, God. So there's no way to establish this definitively. What I can do, though, is puzzle at it. I can ask questions. I mean, there's been so much saying, oh, Muhammad was this and he was that and this is the absolute truth and it was absolutely this. This is exactly what I'm trying to get away from. I'm trying to explore who he was.
The other part that's interesting is a person who's traveled extensively, lived, as you've said, on, I think, three continents, how you've come to think of, which was a critical component of Muhammad's life, this idea of exile and what you regard as home. This seems something that really interests you.
Yeah, the hijra, what Muslims call the hijra, is usually translated as the emigration from Mecca to Medina. Medina was about 200 miles north of Mecca. And basically, Muhammad was hounded out of Mecca. The establishment, the elite of the time, saw him as a subversive threat to the status quo, to their way of doing things. And basically, Mecca at the time was, in a way, it was a kind of 7th century Arabian equivalent of a Wall Street bull market.
Right.
It was a very, very prosperous city. And the prosperity came from a very, very canny combination of piety and trade. It was a hub of trade, huge camel caravans, by which I mean 2,000 at a time, south to Yemen and north to Damascus. It was a sort of central node in that whole trade. So there was huge profit there. And then, of course, it had the shrine that we now know as the Kaaba, which attracted people from all over Arabia, and the ruling tribe of Mecca ran the shrine for profit. You had to pay for everything. You had to pay for water. You had to pay for food. You had to pay for the right to pitch your tent. You had to pay for the special clothes that you wore to circumambulate the Kaaba and so on. You had to pay for sacrifices to be made. Pay.
Yeah.
So it was... It was, as I say, a very prosperous city with all the corruption and greed that you would expect to come with such kind of nouveau riche prosperity. And this is what Muhammad saw with a very acute outsider's eye. Mm-hmm. He was part of that ruling tribe, but he had been born right on the margins of it by virtue of having been born an orphan.
Yeah.
I know this sounds strange. He was born an orphan. That is, his father died before he was even born. In fact, his father died without even knowing that he had a son, or that he had, you know, sired a son.
Well, and if the legend is to be believed, as you put it, his grandfather nearly killed his father just hours before he was conceived.
Yes, and that is obviously a very, very Abrahamic kind of thing, you know, with,
right.
with the Abraham and Isaac, or Abraham and Ishmael, whichever way you see it.
Yeah.
So there's, you know, there's lots of echoes and resonance and reverberations there with the biblical stories.
Yeah.
And in fact, you know, it should be noted that one third of the Quran does reprise many, many of the stories from the Bible.
Yeah.
But where were we?
Let me back up for a moment, because I do want to have you play out that story, because it's this is what the book is about. But I guess what I was interested in first is... it must be difficult writing about Muhammad when you have a figure so revered by a people, that so revered that it's blasphemy to create an image of the man. That must be strange territory to put, you know, flesh on that bone when it's such a revered figure, when there's so much connected to just an image of the man itself.
Oh, I will upfront say it was took me 4 years to write the book, and I was very, very aware that I was walking a kind of tightrope here, as an outsider, as an agnostic, as a Jew, writing about a figure so revered by so many people and at the same time so reviled by so many people. So in a way you could say that this was an act of ultimate chutzpah on my part. But what really drove me was this desire to get to accord him the respect and the integrity of a full life lived, to be able to see him clearly through, to go past the many legends about him, to go beyond the many misconceptions and the stereotypes and so on, and to get a really deep sense of the man who came out of this place? And basically, that was my basic question. Yeah. Why this man in this time, in this place? Mm. How did this happen? And what did it feel like?
Do we know what Muhammad really looked like?
We have, in fact, I started out the book this way.
Yeah.
There are many accounts that say that he was, and this is from the earliest Islamic biographies, well, he was neither tall nor short, he was neither thin nor stout and so on, and you can go a little bit nuts this way.
Yeah.
But here and there, if you read deeply into them, you can find small details that emerge and you begin to get a picture. I mean, you know, we imagine prophets as they must be sort of gaunt, ascetic-looking figures, but in fact, he was rotund and rosy-cheeked. We know that when he stood, he leaned forward somewhat, as though he was sort of leaning towards something. We know that when he turned to speak to you, he would turn his whole body instead of just his head, which seems to indicate that he had a stiff neck or a back problem or something. And you put all these details together. We know that he very rarely laughed, which is kind of understandable when you have that vast weight of prophethood on top of you.
Right.
You put all these details together and it becomes surprising. You know, a surprising picture. We also know that the only sense in which he was conventionally handsome was the long sort of swooping hawk nose that was considered a sign of, and still is, a sign of nobility in the Middle East. So we do have some indication of what he looked like.
Yeah. And of course, coming back to where we left off there a moment ago, the idea that he was born in an orphan, which is crucial, you say, to understanding, I guess, the perspective by which he sees the world and by which he kind of navigates his family life and the life, because he's the ultimate. He's born into this family, which is a sort of a noble family, but by the same token, he is an orphan. So inside, yet outside, and I guess that gives him not even his perspective, but his kind of a sense of wisdom about seeing the world. Yeah. Almost
the outsider's eye, though it's not a comfortable one to see with, is also an extraordinarily clear one. And since he was born basically marginalized, and you know, to be an orphan at that time was different than it was now. It went much deeper. So in a sense, he was born into a certain kind of exile. Mm-hmm. You asked about exile before, and of course that exile would be doubled when he was basically hounded out of Mecca to Medina, and the Hijra was basically exile, not merely emigration. So you can trace the whole of his life as this passage, this amazing arc from the outsider-insider or insider-outsider through to the absolute outsider, the sense of being totally rejected and exiled. And then 8 years later, he returns to Mecca as the ultimate insider. It is the most amazingly dramatic story.
Mm-hmm.
And I think our problem with being able to see Muhammad is that it has been told, I don't want to be too rude here, but it's been told so badly in the past for Westerners. The early Islamic biographies, you get all this juice, this vitality,
yeah,
there's people actually talking, and you really get a strong sense of place. But they're told in this way that Westerners can't stand. It's not a linear, chronological narrative. And the way it's been told in modern times is, it's kind of soporific, in fact, by the end of it.
Yeah.
So I came to it very much as a writer concerned with narrative, seeing this immensely dramatic story and wanting to do justice to it.
You know, you write about that he lived for many years this life in the desert, no luxuries to speak of, but it would have been a healthy life. You talk about camel milk and grains and pulses, and you get a sense that it wasn't a bad childhood, or that it must have been kind of fun in some ways. is that fair to say?
I'm not sure any Bedouin would agree with you. It's a hard, hard life.
Yeah.
What happened was that he was farmed out as a foster child to Bedouin for the first 5 years of his life, which in itself was unusual.
Right.
If that happened, it was usually about 2 years. And it was done for very, very good reasons. Because at that time, you know, infant mortality was so high, a child's chances of surviving infancy were far higher away from the city, where the people may not have known about germs and so on, but they did know the children died at an immensely high rate inside the city, and that they were far safer health-wise outside the city. So it took 5 years for him to be returned to Mecca. And in those 5 years, those very, very formative 5 years, of course, he really, he got a sense of the enormous egalitarianism of Bedouin life, and an appreciation of the fact that the world is much larger than we are, and sort of living basically it's a subsistence living as a Bedouin. I'm kind of acquainted with this because I spent a year working with Bedouin in the Sinai. It's a very, very hard life, but at the same time, it kind of there's a purity to it, a cleanliness to it. And to come back from there to the immensely packed and city of Mecca with all its corruption and wealth, and the obverse of wealth, which is the vast number of people who were in who were disenfranchised, who were just barely eking out a living as slaves or in indentured servitude, was a real shock to the values of this five-year-old boy, and even more so when a year, just 1 year after he returns to Mecca, his mother also dies.
Yeah.
He's only known her for 1 year, and now he's doubly orphaned, and he gets shunted from home to home and so on. I think it was a very, very difficult childhood and an excellent education, let us say, in being the outsider.
Well, and the result of it, of course, as you write about, is that he builds a kind of reputation for being fair, not being greedy, not being opportunistic. And, of course, this catches the eye of the woman who would become his wife. She, in fact, proposes to him, Khadija. And this is a very important their relationship is really important and very unusual, you say, because it wasn't a sort of political alliance. It wasn't – it was, I guess, rare for the time because it was so close. There was a lot of love and caring and
love.
Respect.
It was a love match. He was married to Khadija in a very, very happy, clearly very happy, loving, monogamous relationship for 24 years until her death. The nine late-life wives he married were mainly for matters of diplomatic alliance and so on, because by then he was a leader and you had to make those marriages, as all leaders of the time did. But he would mourn Khadija until the day he died, and he made that very, very clear. She was the one true love of his life. What happened was that he worked his way up. He was put, after his mother died, he was put to work as a camel boy on the big camel caravans, trade caravans. He worked his way up to become a trader's agent, representing the interests of others, and became very good at it because of this reputation for trustworthiness. He was known as the Amin, the trustworthy one. And one of his clients was Khadija, who was twice widowed, and had inherited an interest in the share in the camel caravans from her second husband. And as you say, she was 15 years older than him. And it was she who proposed to him because, of course, he could not propose to her. He had no means of his own and so on. She was far higher in status than he was. But she saw something here that was really valuable. And she most definitely had no need for another arranged marriage. She was that rare thing at the time, and even still, an independent woman of means.
Yeah.
And that marriage was pivotal to his accepting what would his role as prophet, which still lay in the future at the time.
Right, of course. Well, here's the thing that they seemed to share in terms of their values. He didn't care that much about the money, I guess. He cared for the people. He seemed to almost, as you say in the book, disdain the profit motive that ruled Mecca at the time, gave away his commissions to the poor. And I guess this concern for the inequities of Meccan society was the thing that he shared with her. They were kindred spirits in this way, I guess.
They were indeed. They could see what was wrong. They could see that this combination of profit and piety that was going on in Mecca was, they could see the hypocrisy of it. And they could see the cruelty of it. And Khadija was very close. One of her uncles, Warika, was a famous, what it was called at the time, Hanif.
Yes.
Hanif was, it's a general term, and you know, a rough translation might be monotheist. He was not Christian, not Jewish, but he was monotheist as opposed to the polytheism that was that was prevalent at the time. By the way, when I say polytheism, I don't mean that there were lots of gods duking it out between them. Everybody believed in the one supreme God, who was Allah, the High One.
Yes.
The same God, by the way, as Elohim in Hebrew, or El in Sumeria or in Phoenicia. All means the High One. But there were lots and lots of sort of junior associates of that God, as it were. And these were mainly sort of totem stones, stones that stood out in the desert, monoliths and so on, that were brought back. And these could be touched. You know, the High One, Allah, was beyond human connection, too remote, you know. But actual stones, you could touch them. You could kneel before them. You could sacrifice to them. You could pour out libations to them. You could make oaths in front of them. They were concrete. And I think it's a very, very human need to want something concrete, to be able to touch something of the divine, to want something more accessible than this vast, remote being whom we call God.
Mm. You say Muhammad himself didn't think of himself necessarily as a Hanif, but he did feel a kind of kinship with them, and he did take on this practice, which, and this is crucial, this form of meditation that they practiced, which involved this this solitary vigil.
Right. Yes, that was a Hanif practice, and what they did was they would go out to the mountains, basically vigil retreat, we would call it nowadays, perhaps, but alone in the mountains outside Mecca, hoping perhaps for, well, certainly not revelation, but perhaps for a quiet, what anyone hopes for if they go on retreat now, a small epiphany, perhaps not even that, but a quiet, intimate moment of insight.
There's a lovely bit of writing here. I wanted you to read a section, if you wouldn't mind, this part of the book where you talk about Muhammad taking these vigils into the mountains. Read this section,
pleasure,
if you would.
Mm. Okay, here's from page 70. The red granite of the Hijaz Mountains was no smooth, zen-like stone, but jagged rock, so harsh it would bloody your hands if you fell and clung to it. Yet there was also immense beauty in such harshness. Wrapped in his threadbare robe against the gathering chill of early evening, Muhammad would watch as the monotonous glare of day gave way to a rich light that mellowed the mountains into gold. There'd be a slight tremor inside him as the sun abruptly slipped from sight, leaving the western horizon to glow with colour before fading, as though someone were languorously drawing a heavy veil over it. A while yet, and moon shadows would begin to silver the landscape. Or there'd be the ethereal cold light of the star-studded sky at new moon. And then the quality of time itself seemed to change, as though he could sense it stretching into infinity, until at last the merest hint of light paling the eastern sky brought with it a chill pre-dawn breeze, the signal that time had returned and the night's vigil was almost done. Did he practice breathing exercises on these vigils? The kind of exercises only now being rediscovered in the West, but widely used by mystics throughout history? What is prayer, after all, if not a form of breath control? The long rhythmic incantation, the trance-like meter, the reverberation of sound in the mouth and the throat and the chest, the cyclical act of inhalation and exhalation, all these create an awareness of ruh, a word that means wind in Arabic, but also breath and spirit, as though the spirit is born on the wind or in the breath. Did Muhammad repeat the ancient pilgrim's chant, "Here I am, O God, here I am," or find a new one taking form in his mouth, "La ilaha illallah, there is no God but God"? Did sibilance take over his body, his breath slowing and deepening as the soft musical chant enchanted the tongue, rolling from deep inside him out into the empty night? Alone here on the mountain, away from the swirl of competing claims and narratives, Did he find the clarity he was seeking? Or at least a calm acceptance of his apartness? A certain peace?
Leslie Hazelton. Her book is called The First Muslim. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the Islamic prophet Muhammad. Our guest is the journalist Leslie Hazelton, who's written a biography. Her book is called The First Muslim, A Story of Muhammad. Hazelton tries to steer clear of the sentiment or piety or bigotry and draw a portrait of a leader who fought against greed and corruption and who cared about social justice and about unity. As Leslie Hazelton puts it, unity, both human and divine. So there's a story that you tell about how Muhammad, before he has the experience on Mount Hira, how he establishes a kind of relationship. There's this moment when the sacred sanctuary, the Kaaba, is sort of destroyed. And Muhammad kind of emerges from all of this turmoil and competition because everyone's fighting about who should be the tribe or the people who fix it and restore it. Yeah. And he comes with this kind of King Solomon's approach. And he's enough of an insider to be relevant, but enough of an outsider as to be seen as objective.
Right.
Tell the story, if you would.
Right, the perfect role for him. Well, the Kaaba is a very, very unusual shrine in that usually we think of, I mean, in ancient times, almost always, the holy place was a high place. It was the place nearest to God, as it were, nearest to the heavens. And if you think of, you know, the always on top of mountains in Jerusalem, in Athens, and so on, the Kaaba was very, very unusual in that it was the lowest place in Mecca. So instead of being sort of the crown of the city, as it were, it was its navel, and everything sort of centered around it. And Mecca is sort of inside this kind of bowl. It's surrounded by mountains. So you've got the lowest point here, which means also that it's in the flood path. When there's flash floods in winter, they all gather there. And the worst flash flood happened. Muhammad was 35 at the time. It was 5 years before the first revelation. And the Kaaba was completely swept away and had to be rebuilt. And there was one stone that is still there, set in the northeast corner, called the Black Stone, and it's probably a meteorite. It's an extraordinary rich stone, which is in fact only about the size of a large football, but is set in today in this sort of large silver frame and so on. And this was considered a sacred stone, so the various tribes of Mecca got into an argument which threatened to develop into a very, very violent argument about who would have the honor of replacing the Black Stone, of putting it back into its place in the rebuilt Kaaba. And finally, somebody comes up with the idea. They decide, okay, we will just go with the judgment of whoever is the first one to cross the threshold now. And as it happened, of course, it was Muhammad who had just come down from retreat on Mount Hira.
Right.
And the story, as it's told in the early biographies and histories, of course, takes it for granted that it will be Muhammad if it had been anybody else. It's almost as though it couldn't have been anybody else.
Right.
Muhammad sees what's going on. He sees, to his great distress, that people are on the verge of fisticuffs and pulling out their daggers and so on. And he can't believe that something so sacred should be causing such divisiveness. And what he does is, as you say, a very Solomonic resolution. He lays out his cloak on the ground and he instructs them to put the stone on the cloak. And then he gets everybody to take one corner or one edge of the cloak and then they all raise it together as it sits in the cloak. And then he is the one who actually puts it into place. And this they were willing to accord him because he was, by then, the Amin, the trustworthy one, because, as you say, they relied on him to be objective. But it is a story that's sort of beautiful in its sense of resolving difference by inclusiveness, by everybody taking an equal role. And at the same time, I think is indicative of his great distress at seeing the potential for such divisiveness.
It's about unity, that story.
And, it is,
and much of what he teaches is about unity in his life.
Yes, and I think this was especially important for a man for whom, you know, from birth, because of his orphanhood, because of the spending the first 5 years away from home with the, with the Bedouin, because of the death of his mother when he was age six, and then the death of his grandfather, father, and so on, was searching for unity, for personal as well as social, cultural, much greater aims. I think there's a very close connection here between the personal and the theological, if you like, and the political and the cultural.
Right. Well, let's talk about that first revelation. It's of course he's 40, which you spent some time talking about how auspicious that is as a number in the Middle East, and it was the month of Ramadan, 610, and he does what he has done for a few years. He seeks vigil, solitude on Mount Hira. And he has this visit, of course, by the angelic visitor Gabriel. And it's interesting the way you write about this story, because his reaction to it, there aren't these, you know, trumpets. He doesn't come back down, you know, bathed in glory. He isn't crazy about the fact that this happened to him. In fact, he has this impulse to kill himself. And you describe in the book how his reaction is just completely a human one. That he figures he's going crazy, I guess.
I think it's the only sane reaction. The only human reaction was his. He was terrified. What happened in his own reported words was this enormous weight on him, enormous weight that he was struggling against, and it was as though it was trying to suffocate him. He was convinced that he was going to die under this weight. And then when it finally lifted, he couldn't believe that it had happened to him. There's this voice telling him that he's the prophet of God, and he's like, well, who, me? Who am I, right? You know, I must have lost my mind here. I must be either a poet, which was, you know, somebody of great imagination at the time, good and bad senses, or a madman is what he reportedly thought to himself.
And he didn't like either of those figures either.
And, you know, and if so, nobody... If this is true, then nobody's ever going to say this of me. So his first impulse was to run as high as he could up the mountain and then try to throw himself off to put an end to the terror of this experience. Because what had happened was that, you know, here is this unbridgeable gulf taken for granted between the human and the divine, and he'd crossed it.
Yeah.
The voice of God speaking to him through the angel Gabriel, this was impossible to someone like him, an ordinary man, a trader, a man who sought nothing more than just, you know, a little peace in his life. This couldn't be. So he was in complete terror of this.
Yeah.
And we know that he did not come down the mountain sort of like as though he were walking on clouds. He did not come down shouting, hallelujah, and bless the Lord, and I see the truth, and I have the light, and so on. There were no choirs of angels and, you know, no music of the spheres. He came running down in fear and trembling. And he ran all the way down that mountain to the one person with whom he could seek shelter from the terrors of the night, and that was his wife, Khadija. And it was she who held him, and she who soothed him, and she who reassured him that if what you say is true, you may indeed be the prophet of this people. And without her, without her role, maybe he would have lost his mind, because what else can you do? It is just such a human story. The impossible story would be if he had walked down convinced that he was the prophet, right? The human story, the real story to me, is that he walked down convinced that he'd lost his mind, ran down convinced that he'd lost his mind, because he couldn't be the prophet.
Yeah.
And in fact, it took two more years. After that first revelation, which was just the five very, very brief but beautiful verses, there were 2 years of silence. And this also I find utterly convincing. It's not that they started coming at regular intervals like you have a direct phone line to the Lord and so on. There were 2 years of silence in which he struggled within himself. What St. John of the Cross would have called the dark night of the soul,
right,
in which he a kind of purification process, if you like, or a struggle within himself to accept the immensity of this role. He'd gone up to this mountain in the hope of a little peace, some insight, and said this blinding, terrifying weight of revelation, the terrifying responsibility, this burden of what had been put on him. Very much he experienced this throughout the rest of his life, the burden of prophethood.
That 2 years where nothing came, as mm-hmm. you put it, is so interesting because that sense of doubt, you write, mm-hmm. Was really crucial to the way he would, the way he would think and write. You write that the Quran would become this, come to urge this kind of Socratic dialogue with unbelief.
Right.
How faith would require this, as you put it, an awareness of the possibility of being wrong.
Mm-hmm. And I realize that this is very, very difficult for many believing Muslims to accept because there is a strong tradition within Islam that Muhammad was, quote-unquote, the perfect man. But to me, first of all, I think it can be said that if there is perfection, it belongs. It's divine and not human. And Muhammad made it very, very clear, and it's clear all through the Quran, where Muhammad is told to say, and the Quran, by the way, is entirely in the voice of God, speaking to Muhammad.
Right.
And he's told again, several times in the Quran, to say, I am just one of you. I am just a man. And as a man, you know, the idea of perfection is very two-dimensional. And when you want to see someone in all their dimensions, then of course there will be imperfections too. And this is what makes it so interesting to me, is the struggle within himself to accept his role, the grace with which he finally accepted the burden of it, to me are quite extraordinary.
Lesley Hazleton is with us. Her book is The First Muslim, The Story of Muhammad. We need to take another break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the journalist Lesley Hazleton. We're talking about her book, The First Muslim, The Story of Muhammad. So you talk about the fact that for 2 years nothing comes, and then at last it does.
Mm-hmm.
The revelations known as the Surah of the Morning, these mm-hmm. 11 brief verses. And I wanted to, you mentioned them. I wanted to read them because you talk about the language in them.
Yeah.
And I wanted to spend some time with that because this must be the most difficult thing, translating these ideas, these ineffable concepts, as you talk about, into words at first, and then into translating them into English, I think is interesting. The 11 brief verses here, by the morning light and the dark of night, your Lord has not forsaken you, Muhammad, nor does he abhor you. The end shall be better than the beginning.
Yeah.
And
lovely. There's God telling him after these 2 years of intense internal struggle and loneliness and sense of abandonment and self-doubt, his God telling him, your Lord is not forsaken.
Yeah.
You.
And you will
You're
be satisfied.
Okay. I'm back with you again.
Yeah.
You know?
And did he not find you an orphan and give you shelter? Did he not find you in error and guide you? Did he not find you poor and enrich you?
Mm-hmm.
And then he says, do not wrong the orphan then, mm-hmm. nor chide the beggar, but proclaim the goodness of your Lord. So this is about I guess for a Christian, it's hard not to see the connection between this and the idea of charity by Jesus. And you talk about the kind of the parallels here, but talk about that message here because it's very, very simple, but really rich and full of wonder and awe, as you put it.
Well, yes, the Quran is deeply rooted in the Bible, both in the Hebrew Bible and in the Gospels. And there's great respect for them. Jesus, of course, is one of the main prophets of Islam.
Right.
And the values, I mean, this was Muhammad's whole point. He did not come in order to found a new religion. He came to call people back to the values of established monotheism. And which he felt were being, which obviously were being, you know, diverged from. And it's these basic values, the ethics and the morality of monotheism that he wanted to call people back to. So what he wanted basically was not, though he did create a revolution, that was not his aim. His aim was reform. Mm. It was to call people back to their better selves and to the better values of what already existed but had been abandoned or ignored or gone away from because of the political and economic development of Mecca and the way people were just traducing all traditional values. Mm. So although his message was seen as radical,
yeah,
of course, you know, by the powers that be, I don't think he considered it as such. I don't think he realized how radical it would be to them. And the interesting thing here is that if the elite of Mecca had not recognized it, I think before even Muhammad did, we might never have heard of him. Because what happened was that once they realized that this threatened the status quo, it threatened their position as being in charge and their prophets and so on, they instigated a concerted campaign of harassment of him and what was at the time a very small group of followers. And interestingly, those followers were the same kind of followers as the earliest Christians, the earliest followers of Jesus, who also, by the way, did not set out to create a new religion. He wanted to bring people back to the values of the existing religion. But those followers were those who were out of power. It included women, who, of course, were not in any kind of power at the time. It included second and third and fourth sons, and all the power went to the first son. It included slaves. It included freed slaves. It included indentured servants. It included all the people whom the elite of Mecca were quoted at that time as calling these nobodies. So it would have been far easier for the elite to just ignore this small movement that had arisen in their midst around Muhammad. Instead, because they took such an active role against him, it boomeranged against him, against them. The more they tried to rile people up against him, the more people were interested in hearing what had so infuriated these people in power, these rich, wealthy men who ran the city.
Mm.
So basically, they did his public relations for him, as it were.
You know, it's interesting you describe the earlier revelations as like exquisite poems.
Mm-hmm.
They could be really short and they could be dense, like haiku, you say.
Yes.
But it seems like there's a point at which they change. And the later ones become longer and more involved with the issues of the moment. And I guess if you're reading the Quran, these longer ones are the ones you see first. You don't get to those really beautiful ones unless you really are patient and work your way to the back.
Exactly. Somebody in whatever wisdom prevailed at the time, shortly after Muhammad's death, and it's not clear exactly who, but let's say it was Uthman, the third caliph, decided that the Quran should be arranged, first of all, into surahs, into chapters. It didn't come down this way. Muhammad received both longer and shorter revelations, you know, maybe one verse at a time, maybe several verses at a time, over a period of 23 years. By the time they were written down, they had been arranged into chapters. And I mean, one can sense the desire for pattern. What happened was that the longer ones were placed first, sort of working down in size towards the shorter ones at the end. Unfortunately, what this means for any Westerner trying to read the Quran is that it is immensely difficult to read because the shorter ones reflect the more mystical earlier revelations of the Quran, and they're right at the end, as you say. And the longer ones, which comes towards the beginning, are very, very densely involved with what was happening at the time. Basically, their responses to questions from his followers as, what should we do? Or responses to this battle or that battle. And there were three battles between Medina, of which Muhammad had become the leader, and Mecca in the 8 years before he returned to Mecca as the ultimate insider, acclaimed as the leader of Mecca as well. So it was full of questions as to what should we do? What should we do if they attack us? What should we do if they won't let us near the shrine, if they won't let us make pilgrimage and so on? And unless you can understand this historical background, they're not going to make any sense. So with all due respect and without any desire to insult anybody, I very often tell Western non-Muslim readers of the Quran that that perhaps they should read it from the back towards, you know, as though it were in Arabic, from right to left.
Right.
Because if you want to get a sense of the mystical underpinnings of the Quran, you'll get a much better sense of it that way. And that to understand the first several long surahs, you really need to know the history of what's going on, which, of course, you can achieve by reading this book.
Right. There's a terrific story you tell. Muhammad at first doesn't go public with the verses at first.
Right.
In fact, for almost a year, only Khadija really would have heard about these revelations. Mm-hmm. And as the story goes, Gabriel finally gives him the go-ahead, I suppose.
Right.
And he's supposed to prepare this meal, wheat and mutton, and mm-hmm. and invite his kinsmen to dine. And this is the part of the story I wanted you to talk about. He sings to them. It's this form called saj.
Yes, saj. Sort of cooing or whispering. And it was a style in which pre-Islamic Bedouin poetry was told. It's very, very beautiful. And I've heard Bedouin elders recite, you know, long narrative poems this way for hours on end, entirely by memory, in the desert, in the Sinai. And it's extraordinarily beautiful and kind of haunting. But this was even more so. And it was all the more unexpected because Muhammad, again, that outsider, somebody who had learned the hard way to listen and to watch rather than to speak, coming all the more from this man who was known as quite terse, who never sort of put forward his own thoughts, you know, unless specifically asked. So to hear this beauty, this extraordinarily beautiful, heightened, musical Arabic coming from this man known for speaking so tersely was quite astonishing. And it was kind of just enchanting, except, of course, for one of his uncles, one of his kinsmen, who in fact would become one of his leading critics and harassers and lead the move to exile him from Mecca.
So he invites them back.
Invites them back the next day. That particular uncle stood up and said, this is nonsense, this is obamom, etc., and walked out, which was unheard of at the time, to walk out on hospitality in this way. But he called everybody back. And this time, you know, without the presence of that particular uncle, and there were several uncles involved in this story, things went much better. So, yes, the first person to hear the Quran spoken by Muhammad was Khadija, his wife. Mm. Then, 2 years later, it's his closest kin, his uncles and his cousins and so on. And only then, gradually, does it become open preaching in Mecca at the Kaaba. And that is the stage at which the Meccan elite basically declare war on him.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. You write about the society that Muhammad envisions. It's kind of a proto-democracy where these caste systems of birth and mm-hmm. wealth would kind of fall by the wayside. And there is that bitter irony that you write about, that many of these concepts have, of course, been distorted. You know, the role of women, the question of you know, violence and all of those kinds of things. Where do you think we've settled? And I guess it's different for different people in terms of the way we think of Muhammad now.
Oh, what happens once the founder dies, once the originator dies? You know, I've now written about early Judaism and early Christianity and early Islam, and there was no doubt in my mind that all three began as movements of social justice, as movements of protest against corruption. In the case of Judaism, it was the corruption of kings. In the case of Christianity, it was the corruption of occupation by the Romans and of collaboration with occupation. And in the case of Islam, it was the corruption of wealth and greed and of an oligarchy, the ruling elite. But, you know, humans are just humans. The founding figure, let us say, dies, and then that's when you begin to get what I call the architecture of religion, the infrastructure, the girders of it, right? And that's when you begin to get the dogma and the rules and so on. And this wonderful idealism of the founding figures begins to disappear, begins to get hedged about with dogma. And I think if we can get back to that original idealism, no matter which faith we go with, or no faith at all, it's still this is faith. The idealism that we can live in a better society, we can create a better society. And this is, in fact, what Muhammad began to do once he was exiled in Medina. He created an act of extraordinary idealism. He created a whole new political entity there which superseded the old tribal divisions and brought everybody together, including the Jewish tribes. And yes, there were three Jewish tribes in Medina at the time. And it was an extraordinary vision. And that was the original vision of Islam, which, of course, it gets lost once you lose touch with the cultural, the historical, the philosophical, the idealistic aspect of it, once you begin to insist on dogma, once you become fundamentalist. Fundamentalism, to my mind, is fundamentally anti-religious. It has no feel for the sense of religion. It insists instead on just the outer garments of it, the outer girdings of it, the rules, the regulations, and so on. In a sense, it destroys religion.
Leslie Hazelton, she's the author of the book, The First Muslim, The Story of Muhammad. We should also mention she blogs at The Accidental Theologist, and you can find a link to that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Leslie Hazelton, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you, Doug. It's been a delight.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Taylor Almond. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.